First in the prophecy of Jeremiah and chapter 34, please. Jeremiah chapter 34 and verse 18. Jeremiah 34 and 18. And I will give the men that have transgressed my covenant, which have not performed the words of the covenant which they have made before me, when they cut the calf in twain and passed between the parts thereof, the princes of Judah and the princes of Jerusalem, the eunuchs and the priests and all the people of the land, which passed between the parts of the calf, I will even give them into the hand of their enemies and into the hand of them that seek their life. And their dead bodies shall be for meat upon the fowls, unto the fowls of the heaven, unto the beasts of the earth. 1 Samuel chapter 26, please. 1 Samuel 26. And the Ziphites came to Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Achillah, which is before Jeshimon? Then Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him, to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul pitched in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon by the way. But David abode in the wilderness. And he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness. David therefore sent out spies and understood that Saul was come in very deed. And David arose and came to the place where Saul had pitched. And David beheld the place where Saul lay, and Abner the son of Ner, the captain of his host. And Saul lay in a trench, and the people pitched round about him. Then answered David and said to Ahimelech the Hittite, and to Abishai the son of Uriah, brother to Joab, saying, Who will go down with me to Saul to the camp? And Abishai said, I will go down with thee. So David and Abishai came to the people by night. And behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, and his spear stuck in the ground at his bolster. But Abner and the people lay round about him. Then said Abishai to David, God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day. And now therefore, let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, even to the earth at once, and I will not smite him the second time. David said to Abishai, Destroy him not. Who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? David said furthermore, As the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him. Or his day shall come to die. Or he shall descend into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. But I pray thee, take thou now the spear that it is his bolster and the cruse of water, and let us go. So David took the spear and the cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and they got them away. No man saw it, nor knew it, neither awaked. But they were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen upon them. Then David went over to the other side, stood on the top of a hill afar off, a great space being between them. And David cried to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, Answerest thou not, Abner? Then Abner answered and said, Who art thou that criest to the king? David said to Abner, Art not thou a man? Who is like thee in Israel? Wherefore then hast thou not kept thy lord the king? For there came one of the people in to destroy the king thy lord. This thing is not good that thou hast done. As the Lord liveth, ye are worthy to die. because ye have not kept your master, the Lord's anointed. Now see where the king's spear is, and the cruse of water that was at his bolster. And Saul knew David's voice, and said, this thy voice, my son David? David said, it is my voice, my lord, O king. And he said, wherefore doth my lord thus pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is in mine hand? Now therefore I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the words of his servant. If the Lord have stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering. But if they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord. For they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go, serve other gods. Now therefore let not my blood fall to the earth before the face of the Lord. For the king of Israel is come out to seek a flea, as when one doth hunt a partridge in the mountain. Then said Saul, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do thee harm, because my soul was precious in thine eyes this day. Behold, I have played the fool, and I have erred exceedingly. And David answered and said, behold the king's spear. Let one of the young men come over and fetch it. The Lord render to every man his righteousness and his faithfulness. For the Lord delivered thee into my hand today, but I would not stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed. And behold, as thy life was much set by this day in mine eyes, so let my life be much set by in the eyes of the Lord, and let him deliver me out of all tribulation. Then Saul said to David, blessed be thou, my son David. Thou shalt both do great things, and also shalt still prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. Last of seven chapters of our book occupied with Saul's enmity against David, and closes with the parting, the final parting, of the two men. As we saw in an earlier session, there are many similarities between this chapter and chapter 24. But there are also many differences, perhaps the most significant being that in chapter 24, David was on the defensive, whereas here in chapter 26, very much on the offensive. In chapter 24, David had been hiding from Saul when Saul just happened to come to the place where David was hiding. This time, David actively seeks Saul out and leads a night raid into his camp. Chapter 24 was an instance of David's restraint when given an opportunity to kill Saul. Chapter 26 is a demonstration of David's ability to put himself in a position to kill him. In other words, this time, David is in control, not only of himself, just about Abishai, but of the situation. Now it's possible, I suppose, I do not know, I have no inner secrets, that the Holy Spirit recorded these two very similar incidents to reinforce the message. As you know, the Jews laid great store by double testimony. It's all the Deuteronomy 19:15 stuff. At the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. The principle carried forward, of course, by our Lord and his apostles into the church. And here, for the second time, rerun of the video, David resisted the temptation to harm the Lord's anointed, and Saul admitted his own wrongdoing, acknowledging that David would indeed have a great and illustrious future. Now in our chapter there are no less than 6 references to Saul's spear. So I therefore feel justified in heading the chapter, "The Point Made with Saul's Spear." Verses 1 to 4, the Ziphites inform on David again. Now, the Ziphites came to Saul to Gibeah, saying, "Doth not David hide himself in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon?" Jeshimon means the desert. And as you read this with me, you could be excused, I suppose, a feeling of deja vu at that point, because the Ziphites, the people of the city of Ziph, in the hill country of Judah, had betrayed David's whereabouts to Saul on a previous occasion, back in chapter 23. And that in more or less identical words. "Then came up the Ziphites to Saul to Gibeah, saying, Doth not David hide himself with us in strongholds in the wool, in the wood, in the hill of Hakilah, which is in the south of Jeshimon?" They obviously weren't good in inventing words. And now they attempt to gain King Saul's favor once more by helping him locate David. It had been a narrow thing for David last time. Maybe this time it'll be different. But it's especially sad, is it not, that men of Judah, David's own tribe, should be so ready, persistently, to betray their future king to a man from Benjamin. Verse 2, "Then Saul arose, went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having 3,000 chosen men of Israel with him." Now clearly Saul, which is what verse 1 tells you, had returned home to Gibeah. That was his base camp. He'd given up pursuing David, at least for the time. But then the arrival and renewed offer of these very helpful informers prompted the man to reassemble his standing army of 3,000 men and set off to stalk David again, going back on the assurances, the explicit assurances, which he'd given him at the close of chapter 24, you may remember. Because though Saul had then been greatly moved emotionally, good intentions didn't last very long. And his response to this offer of the men of Ziph provides a clear biblical illustration of the principle that if sin is not dethroned and mortified, then it will pretty soon recover its strength, and when suitable temptation is presented, it will break out again with renewed, sometimes increased force and power. Now we might wonder for our part why it was, having been betrayed previously in the wilderness of Ziph, David should so soon have ventured there again. Well, the explanation probably lies back in the last chapter. Because Ziph was near both Maon and Carmel. I haven't made that up, Joshua 15 says that. And what more natural, I ask, that David should seek refuge in the area of Maon, following his marriage to one Abigail, whose home was there. Verses 3 and 4, David abode in the wilderness, saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, sent out spies, and understood that Saul was come in very deed. David, wise, capable commander, constantly monitoring the movements of Saul. And David knew where Saul was, even if Saul didn't know where David was. But it does seem as if David found it hard to believe that after Saul's last words to him, speaking to him as his son, expressing the wish the Lord would reward David well for what David had done in sparing his life and all that, David obviously found it hard to believe that Saul would pursue him again. But when his scouts informed him that he was right, it was really right, David went in person to the hill at night to survey Saul's encampment. And there he spotted Saul and Abner, sleeping soundly in the middle of the camp. Verses 5 to 12. David and Abishai venture into Saul's camp by night. Verse 5, David arose, came to the place where Saul had pitched. Now on the face of it, David's action was mighty strange. Having established that Saul was come in very deed, David arose, but not, as you might have expected, and fled. And escaped. which actually on 8 other occasions since the beginning of chapter 19 you have been told he did. That section of this book has a rash of David fled statements. But this time he arose and he didn't flee, but rather he came to the place where Saul was pitched. What was in David's mind? Perhaps encouraged, I suppose, by the success, short-lived, of his earlier speech, following that unsought, unexpected experience back in chapter 24 at the cave, David apparently hoped that a repetition of the same ploy might win Saul round again. That would, at the very least, buy him some further breathing space, and just possibly lead to a permanent reconciliation. David was a worried man. The sequel shows that David felt under enormous pressure to escape from Saul's pursuit by fleeing from the land of Israel altogether to seek refuge in one of the surrounding lands. And yet, that was the very last thing David really wanted to do. But as David saw it, given the persistent betrayal, even by men of his own tribe, frankly, what other option was there? So it's worth a try, even if it was a very risky try. He beheld the place. The reference in verse 6 to going down shows that David had remained on high ground, relatively high ground. Saul's camp was, verse 3 tells us, by the way. That is, it was near the road, which would have been on low ground. Saul lay in the trench, the people pitched round about him. It's a very rare word translated here. It means a wagon wheel track, and probably refers to the tracks made by the supply wagons, the idea being that the perimeter of Saul's camp was marked by the tracks of his wagons. And it was inside the perimeter of the camp that Saul slept so soundly, to all intent and purpose, safe and secure with his men around him. There were 3,000 of them. Most people can sleep. They got 3,000 people around them. And so David determined to collect, not this time a patch from Saul's robe, but Saul's spear. That symbol of Saul's kingship, which from the earlier chapters of our book, it is clear, the king never let out of his sight. Well, except when his eyes were shut, as now. Verse 6, David said to Ahimelech the Hittite. Now Ahimelech the Hittite, evidently some foreign mercenary, just as Uriah the Hittite, husband of Bathsheba. Many centuries ago, the Hittites had established an extremely powerful empire. It was based north of Syria and was strong enough to threaten Assyria on the one hand and Egypt on the other. It had already lasted 6 centuries and would, in fact, run another 2. It's the only time that this man, Ahimelech, is mentioned. But clearly, he was one of David's closest and most trusted attendants. Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. Now Abishai, Joab, Asahel, are consistently referred to as the sons of their mother, Zeruiah, rather than, as one would have expected, the sons of their father. Now that might be for no higher reason than that Zeruiah happened to be one of David's older sisters. But there might be another reason. I note from 2 Samuel chapter 2 that following the death of Asahel, it says they took up Asahel and buried him in the sepulchre of his father, which was in Bethlehem. So it's quite likely, I think, that the father was already dead. Now Abishai was an exceptional man. He belonged to the second rank, second class of David's mighty men, detailed for us at length in 2 Samuel 23. The first class of three comprised Joshabim, Eleazar and Shammah. Now it is just possible, it's a question over the text there, but anyway, it's possible. Abishai was one of the three courageous men that broke through the Philistine garrison at Bethlehem to bring water to David. Now, given that his dad's sepulchre was in Bethlehem, you know where Abishai came from, same place David did. He didn't know where the well was. Found it with his eyes shut, probably. Though I guess, with the Philistine garrison around, you'd have kept your eyes open. But if this is so, this then is not the only time when the great warrior broke through enemy lines to come back with some water. Go down with me to the camp. I like to compare the encouragement that God gave to Gideon back in Judges chapter 7, about to face odds of 450-1 against. Came to pass the same night, the Lord said to him, "If thou fear to go down with Phurah thy servant down to the host." That's the word translated camp here. That was the camp of the Midianites. "Thou shalt hear what they say, afterwards shall thy hand be strengthened to go down to the host or camp." And in fact their hands were strengthened and they did go down, and it was a very nice story. But David wasn't going down to look for encouragement like Gideon. He was looking for some tangible proof of his loyalty to show to Saul. Looking to collect evidence that he could have killed Saul if he had wanted. So David wasn't wanting, like Gideon, to hear. He was wanting a spear. Now Abishai was certainly a good man for David to have with him. At a later stage in his life, David was extremely glad of Abishai's services. 2 Samuel 21 tells you of that great Ishbi-benob, who was of the sons of the giant, the weight of whose spear weighed 300 shekels of brass in weight. And he, being girded with a new sword, and presumably wanting to use it, thought to have slain David. Not a good idea. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, succored him, that's David, of course, and smote the Philistine and killed him. Good man to have with you if you're going down to that camp. I think I'd have taken Abishai as well. I probably wouldn't have gone down to camp for that matter. Though David had no intention himself of harming Saul, he said nothing of what was in his mind. So it is pretty obvious that Abishai read something very different and rather more violent into David's idea. Verse 7, David and Abishai came to the people by night. Behold, Saul lay sleeping within the trench, his spear stuck in the ground in his bolster, but Abner and the people lay round about him. And so these two good men picked and threaded their way through the sleeping ranks, managed to get past Saul's bodyguards at his bolster. Saul's spear, conspicuous symbol of his rule, stood at his pillow, or more literally, I suppose, the place of his head. Although it isn't mentioned yet, there is a cruse or jar of water alongside. Verse 12 tells us that. Just as there was a cruse or jar of water, same Hebrew expression completely, alongside Elijah's head, when he slept in 1 Kings chapter 19. David could write at one stage in his life, "I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety." That's out of Psalm 4. Well, Saul lay sleeping, but he was hardly dwelling in safety. The two men stood whispering over Saul's sleeping form. In Abishai's eyes, the opportunity was just too good to miss, and he broke out into what for Abishai must have been one of his most theological statements. Abishai said to David, "God hath delivered thine enemy into thine hand this day." David received the same advice he had received earlier in the cave. On both occasions, David's associates, pointed out that the opportunity of killing Saul was no accident. God had clearly provided the opportunity. On a point of detail, I note the word translated delivered differs from that used by David's men back in chapter 24. It's not an important point. The day of which the Lord said unto thee, behold, I will deliver, that is, give thine enemy into thine hand. That's chapter 24. This word means to shut up or to shut in or to enclose. Interestingly, it is the word used by David in his great battle speech to Goliath in chapter 17. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand. Now maybe, that by that reference the Holy Spirit is giving us a deliberate reminiscence. On that occasion, David had been right. And David's hand had indeed slain the Philistine. On this occasion, Abishai also was right. But David had no intention of lifting up his hand or permitting Abishai to lift up his hand against Saul. Now therefore let me smite him, I pray thee, with the spear, even to the earth at once. I will not smite him the second time. Now I gather from my Bible that restraint was not Abishai's strong point. He had a tendency to want to dispose of any unpleasant opponents. You might note, for example, his later proposal made to David to kill cursing Shimei on the spot. I'm in 2 Samuel 16. Then said Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, to the king, why should his dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over, I pray thee, and take off his head. Nor was Abishai actually a man to give up easily. Because much later, in chapter 19, you read, Shimei the son of Gera fell down before the king as he was come over Jordan and said to the king, let not my lord impute iniquity unto me, neither remember that which thy servant did perversely the day my lord the king went out of Jerusalem, that the king should take it to his heart. Thy servant doth know that I have sinned. Behold, I am come the first this day of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. And Abishai the son of Zeruiah answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? No, he didn't forget Abishai. And it was rather a clever description there, which David himself, of course, had regularly given of Saul to mark him out as someone special, very special. This Shimei has cursed the Lord's anointed. And I note that David's men, even his nephew Abishai, and just about his nephew Joab, were at all times subject to orders, subject to his personal authority. They would not normally act without express approval. And I say normally only because of that spontaneous act of loyalty and courage of the three mighty men, of whom Abishai may have been one, who left the security of the cave of Adullam, heedless of danger, marched 12 miles to Bethlehem, broke through the Philistine lines, drew the water from the well, and carried it back for David to drink, but he wouldn't. Long story. Now the words at once do not mean, as we would expect in English, immediately. What Abishai was saying was, with one stroke. In view of what had transpired in the cave back in chapter 24, Abishai may well have thought that though David apparently scrupled to kill Saul with his own hand, he would probably be more than happy for one of his officers to slay him. David, it goes without saying, you didn't ask for volunteers to come down here and risk their life just to look at the king and then go back again. If you really prefer not to do it yourself, let me nail him with the spear to the floor just once. I will not need a second go. I assure you, my one stroke will be so deadly, so instant in effect, there will be neither groan nor sigh to wake Abner or anyone else. Just give me the wink. And when Abishai said he would not need to strike twice, he was right. I suspect that when he arrived with David at Saul's sleeping form, his eyes lit up at the very sight of Saul's spear, because a spear was Abishai's kind of weapon. Because you read in 2 Samuel 23, which you will already have gathered is the list of David's mighty men, Abishai, the brother of Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was chief among three. He lifted up his spear against 300 and slew them. He had the name among three. Was he not most honorable of the three? Therefore, he was their captain. Now, yes, that exploit may well have taken place sometime later, but it is quite clear Abishai was deadly with a spear. Yet Saul may be renowned for the use of his sword, Jonathan for the use of his bow, David for the use of his sling. You just put a spear in Abishai's hand. But I guess that in Abishai's eyes, the irony would have been simply superb. That Saul, the rejected king, should be killed with his spear, the very symbol of his authority and kingship, on top of which, that he should be killed with the very weapon with which, on more than one occasion, back in chapters 18 and 19 of our book, he had sought to slay God's anointed king. David, I imagine Abishai whispering, I know that previously Saul made three attempts to get you with that very spear. He failed. Believe me, I will not fail. Neither will I need to attempt. And it did look, did it not, that God had arranged things to the end, that Saul should now be slain. Now, admittedly, in one sense, the previous opportunity had been a most certain case of God's overruling providence. Saul accidentally wandering into the very cave where David and his men lay hidden. And this time, admittedly, David took the initiative. Ah, yes, but, this time, God is also clearly at work. For there is something even more extraordinary going on than convenient loo stops. That Saul's entire camp was wrapped in what must have been a supernatural slumber. No doubt David's experience in the last chapter had reinforced his conviction, which he'd expressed before that in the cave of En-Gedi, that it would be God's action and not any action of his own which would deliver him from Saul and terminate Saul's reign. So he whispers back in equally theological tones. David said to Abishai, destroy him not, for who can stretch forth his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? Now that command, do not destroy, may actually have been one of David's very common sayings. I note it appears in the titles of three of his Psalms, 57, 58, and 59, two of which were composed when Saul sought his life. Psalm 57 in the cave, it says. Well, that's either Adullam or En-Gedi. 59 in David's house when Saul sent messengers to kill him. Do not destroy. Although David had said something rather similar to his men back in 24, he now had more cause than ever to kill Saul, because Saul had now gone back on his previous promise to leave David alone. I have a nasty suspicion that if I'd been in David's shoes, I might have said, I showed pity to him and spared him before, poured heaped coals of fire on the good man's head, much good it did me. I may be long-suffering, but I'm not daft. Saul had his chance, he blew it. God knows that. And he's given me this second opportunity to sort it out. Well, Malcolm might have thought like that. David didn't. Verse 10. David said furthermore, as the Lord liveth, the Lord shall smite him, or his day shall come to die, or he shall descend into battle and perish. Having told Abishai that it would actually be sinful to lay violent hands upon a person sacred like Saul, he added, it was altogether unnecessary. Because God would sooner or later himself cut Saul off. And here we meet the same kind of patience and restraint we witnessed in chapter 24, but it is now deeper. Because David learnt much from that near fiasco with Nabal, through which the Lord confirmed to David unmistakably that he, the Lord, could be trusted to handle foolish opponents when matters were left in his hand. A point I would suggest, emphasized by the Spirit, by the use of the same verb in both chapters, the Lord smote Nabal and he died, and David's assurance, the Lord shall smite him. David could imagine several ways in which the Lord might remove Saul. One, the Lord might strike him, perhaps some fatal disease or illness, much as he did with Saul's double Nabal. Or his days shall come to die, that is, he will die of what we might say natural causes. Or he will descend into battle and perish, literally, he will descend into battle and be swept away. He will die in the midst of a battle, which is, of course, exactly what happened. David understood God to be at work among men equally in all three of those ways. But in Saul's case, the Lord would be the cause of Saul's death. Not just because of his normal, general, sovereign, overarching will and purpose, but David knew, because vengeance belonged to the Lord, as Abigail had reminded him, and as he himself had acknowledged in the case of Nabal. But of course, David didn't know which of those means the Lord would use to achieve his will and purpose. But then he didn't need to know. It wasn't his province. He knew all he needed to know. Not how it was that providence would work things out, but what it was that obedience required of him, namely, that he did not dispose of the anointed king himself. Verse 11, "The Lord forbid that I should stretch forth mine hand against the Lord's anointed." So David's reply to Abishai ended as it began in verse 9, with this deeply theological reason why David would not permit Abishai to kill him, because whatever Saul had done, he remained and ever would the Lord's anointed. Now, you might notice a subtlety in David's response. In effect, Abishai had said to David, "All right, you can't find it in yourself to kill Saul, then let me do it." But David replies in terms of his own action and responsibility. You notice that? "The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand." As though he's saying to Abishai, "Listen, man, even though it was your hand that physically held the spear and plunged it into Saul, it would be my act, my responsibility for authorizing you to do so." It would be in that very way that much later David would be responsible for the death of Uriah. It was David's business as leader to restrain Abishai, just as it was the responsibility of one Eli earlier in our book to restrain his two sons from their evil practices, which he signally failed to do. And we can't always avoid responsibility for the action of others. Certainly not those over whom God has in one way or another given us some authority, whether that be in the home or possibly just in the assembly. "Take now the spear that it is his bolster and the cruse of water and let us go." Chapter 24, took a hem of Saul's robe. Now orders Abishai to take Saul's ceremonial spear, the insignia of his office, symbol of his kingship, And don't forget the water jug. Now, as far as I can see, there was nothing special about the jug. David didn't offer it back to Saul in verse 22. I don't know what it looked like. Probably one of the small disc-shaped vessels that archaeologists have found from the period. Two handles round the mouth so you could attach it to a strap. David instructed Abishai to bring it. Why? I don't know. Didn't say. Possibly he was thirsty and didn't want to risk hanging around in Saul's camp longer than absolutely necessary, which I would understand. On the other hand, he may have decided deliberately to deprive Saul not only of his weapon but his water, because for a man to be without water in that region constituted a threat to his very life. The man was not only unable to defend an attack with his spear, but a man would die without water in that heat. So was David therefore giving Saul a clear demonstration of just how vulnerable he was, that his life was altogether in David's hands, not only in the sense that Abishai could have sunk his own spear in him, but that David can walk off with his water supply. Verse 12, David took the spear and cruse of water from Saul's bolster, and they gat them away. They came, they saw, they plundered. I suspect Abishai may have felt a little disappointed as he withdrew with his trophies. And I just see this big man, I'm just guessing he's a big man, shaking his head. He and David make their way through the maze of bodies surrounding Saul, Abishai mumbling to himself, "You wouldn't let me do it in the end, risk my life today on a suicide mission for a spear and a jug of water." But then at that point, sorry about that, Abishai didn't know what David had in his mind. "No man saw it, nor knew it, nor awaked." The text actually is very graphic, very lively. "No one saw, no one knew, no one woke." That's how the Hebrew text reads. They were all asleep, because a deep sleep from the Lord was fallen on them. The Holy Spirit pointing out that Saul was helpless because of God's hand on him. Now, on a previous occasion, God's Spirit had rendered him helpless in the presence of David. That's another story. We were there last year. It's in chapter 19, verses 22 to 24. "Now it is sleep deep that does the same." I got it backwards. Deep sleep does the same. Not, of course, that David or Abishai knew anything about that when they set out on their mission. So please, I am not trying to detract from their courage in going. I'm telling you what did happen. They didn't know it would happen. A deep sleep was fallen upon them. I've been to many meetings just like that. And I guess that most preachers and Bible teachers get used to talking in other people's sleep. I've wondered at times, frankly, whether one or two companies I've had occasion to visit adopted Eutyches as their patron saint. But more seriously, you can compare this incident with two incidents recorded in the first book of your Bible, both of which employ exactly the same Hebrew expression, letter for letter. First, Genesis 2. "The Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon Adam, and he slept. Took one of his ribs, closed up the flesh thereof, and the rib made he a woman, brought her to the man." And then, latter part of Genesis 15, following that statement about Abraham's justification by faith. Colossal statement. Context of the covenant made with Abram concerning the promised land, that smoking furnace or oven, if you like, and burning lamp, that flaming torch which passed between the animal sacrificial victims, which on the Lord's instructions Abraham himself had divided. Now, it seems in the ancient Near East that two parties entering into covenant would divide an animal into two parts. They would join hands, not the animals now, but the men, and they would pass between the two parts. That's why I read Jeremiah 34 at the beginning. pass through the pieces of the divided sacrifices. And as they did so, though the Bible doesn't say this, but it does seem pretty clear from Assyrian inscription, that as they went through the divided sacrifices, they would invoke on themselves a curse if they broke that covenant and wished on themselves that they be divided like the animals that they had divided. But there in Genesis 15, of course, in token and symbol, God alone passed through the parts, indicating to Abraham that everything rested on him. Abraham had no obligations to fulfill to receive the covenant promise. It was in that context, Bible, when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abraham. Lo, great darkness fell upon him. Dry speaker. Now those three references, as far as I know, they're the only three. They do point to some great and profound truths. Deep sleep of Adam, Genesis 2. The mystery of Christ and the church. Members of his body, of his flesh, of his bones. For this cause a man leave father and mother, joined to his wife, they too be one flesh. This is a great mystery. I speak concerning Christ and the church. From Ephesians 5, of course. Deep sleep, Genesis 15, points us to the marvel of God's unconditional promise and covenant, into the good of which we too have come, us Gentiles. And the deep sleep of Saul here points us to the movements of God's overruling providence. Verses 13 to 16. Wakey, wakey, Abner. Verse 13, David went over to the other side, stood on the top of a hill afar off, a great space being between them. David stationed himself within hailing range. But at sufficient distance that Saul's men couldn't come at him quickly or easily. And that precaution, which is very different to chapter 24, suggests he trusted Saul less now than then. On a later occasion, Shimei, who was of the house of Saul, similarly left a valley between him and David in order to curse him in 2 Samuel 16. David and his men went by the way, on the road that is, Shimei went along the hillside over against him, cursed as he went, and threw stones at him and cast dust, which I tell you was a very wise precaution given that Abishai was there. On both occasions it was a matter of better safe than sorry. David cried to the people, verse 14, and to Abner, son of Ner, answerest not thou, Abner? Now those words imply to me that David had called out several times. Saul and his men and Abner were sleeping very soundly. Verse 15, David to Abner, art not thou a valiant man who like thee in Israel? Wherefore then hast thou not kept my Lord, the Lord thy king? The Lord, thy Lord the king. David boldly charged Abner as commander-in-chief of Saul's forces with criminal neglect, because as the one chiefly responsible for the protection of the Lord's anointed, he was responsible for this very serious breach of security, which had endangered the life of the king. David made no allowance for the sleep from the Lord. Art not you a man, literally? You're not worthy of the name of a man? You might remember Paul's exhortation to the Corinthians in his last chapter of his first letter. Watch, stand fast in the faith, quit you like men, be strong, urging his unstable readers to have regard to danger inside and outside of the church and to act like mature men. Play the man, says Paul. Perhaps, with an eye to the immature children and babes that he had described back at chapter 3, but that's another story. There came one of the people in to destroy the king, thy lord. The one of the people, of course, was good Abishai, whom David and David alone had kept back from doing just that and destroying the king. Verse 16, the thing is not good you have done. As the Lord liveth, you are worthy to die because you've not kept your master, the Lord's anointed. Please notice from the King James Bible that plural ye. following the thou. It was not Abner who had proved a shoddy bodyguard only. They all had. They were all literally sons of death. What an irony. As the Lord lives, you all deserve to die. David was saying that Saul's men deserved to be court-martialed to a man, executed for failing to protect the life of the king. And the evidence against them was conclusive. Look where the king's spear and water jug are now. See where the king's spear is and the cruse of water at his bolster. So David did make his point with the spear. And you can imagine a dismay, especially for Abner, when they looked into the ground, inches, please, from Saul's head, to see the hole where the spear had been. And David implied very strongly that he cared more for Saul's life than Abner and Saul's bodyguard did, and was saying, in effect, that it was Abner and Saul's bodyguard who really deserved to face a death sentence pronounced on them by Saul, not him. Verses 17 to 20. David makes his final appeal to Saul. Verse 17. Saul knew David's voice and said, "Is this thy voice, my son David?" Asking exactly the same question, the opening question of chapter 24 at the cave. Indeed, it may have been that David's voice across the hillside reawakened Saul's memory of that earlier encounter. But on this occasion, David's voice was the only way Saul would recognize him, unlike previously, because of the darkness as well as the distance. Saul's immediate reference to David as his son, I would suspect, was music to David's ears, reassuring him that his tactic had proved successful. But I note, as possibly David noted, that Saul did not this time shed tears as he had in chapter 24. "Is this thy voice, my son David?" Saul lifted up his voice and wept. Maybe Saul is becoming a little more hardened now. David said, "It is my voice, my lord, O king. Wherefore doth my lord pursue after his servant? What have I done? What evil is in my hand? Now I pray thee, let my lord the king hear the word of his servant. If the Lord have stirred thee up against me, let him accept an offering." Let him literally smell an offering. It's divine satisfaction and pleasure. "If they be the children of men, cursed be they before the Lord. What have I done?" That's the very question he fired at Jonathan back at the beginning of chapter 20. In both cases, it is the testimony of a clear conscience. David quite reasonably assumes that Saul believes him to be guilty, probably because he's been told of some wrongdoing, and therefore should be hunted down and eliminated. Now, David traced that view to one of two possible sources. The second possibility, that men had incited Saul against him, straightforward enough. We hit it back in chapter 24. But I would suggest it's not quite so easy to understand the meaning of the first possibility, that the Lord may have incited the king to seek his life, and that an appropriate offering should therefore be made to the Lord for his acceptance. I think it's true to say the most commonly held view of the passage runs a little bit as follows. That David acknowledged that it was conceivable, at least in theory, that he had done something wrong, and the Lord had stirred up Saul as his instrument and executor, the instrument of his judgment, to deal with that sin. And if that was the case, then Saul, David is saying, has only to tell him what his sin had been, and David would have taken action to appease God's anger, secure his favor by offering the necessary sacrifice, and that done, no longer any need for Saul to continue and pursue and punish David, because God would have pardoned him. But, so the interpretation continues, David was pointing out to Saul that there was, indeed, another possibility, that he was innocent, that he hadn't actually done anything, and it was those who were wrongly accusing David before Saul as having done something wrong, as a dangerous criminal worthy of death, egging Saul on to take action against him. Now, in that case, David says, he wishes a curse before the Lord on these false accusers. It wasn't David who was worthy of death, but those who wrongly accused him. Now that, I think, is a fair statement of the conventional, traditional view of the passage, but frankly it's one I am not convinced fits the bill. I notice that David didn't actually specify who would make this offering. And I suggest, I can't do more than that, that he may not have in mind that he offered a sacrifice at all. I suggest that David's repeated protests of his innocence, both sides of this verse, reinforced by Saul's confession of sin later on, argues most strongly against that interpretation. And I suggest that you try to interpret his words with reference to the wider, broader context. It has been clear since chapter 13 and chapter 15 that the Lord had declared he would cut off Saul himself and his dynasty because of Saul's blatant rebellion against his word, revealed word. And shortly after that revelation, the Lord had withdrawn his spirit from Saul, sending an evil, King James Bible, a harmful, distressing spirit to replace the spirit of the Lord and to fill Saul with alarm, which it did on many occasions. And indeed, David had been introduced into the royal court to bring relief to the king when he was affected by this spirit. Now, that spirit of distress was therefore an instrument of divine judgment on Saul. Made it apparent to everybody, including David, that Saul was unfit to rule. He was the object of God's disfavor. And I think David here is saying to Saul that as he, Saul, was the object of divine judgment, then the proper course of action for him was to appease the Lord with an offering. And David advised him to do it. I know it's not a great deal of evidence, but I do notice that the Septuagint translators understood it that way. They render the central bit of verse 19, "If God stirs thee up against me, let thine offering be acceptable." They've driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, "Go, serve other gods." Now, to some extent, David's words here prepare us for what we're going to meet, shock and horror, in the next chapter, when David reluctantly leaves the land of Israel to take refuge with the Philistines. And I guess that David's enemies in Israel, of which he must have had many, may well have argued later that David was indeed a traitor to his faith. And during his time among the Philistines, he'd actually worshipped, sought protection from the Philistine gods. But David did not mean that he would really worship foreign gods. He was simply drawing the king's attention to the fact that on any foreign territory, there would be no sanctuary or shrine to the Lord where he could worship the true and living God. And that those who incited Saul against him were pressuring him to flee from his own country, and that they might as well have come out and said it. Go serve other gods. It's not that David held the view, which many did, that God, the true God, could be worshipped in a proper and acceptable manner only in his own land. Or to some even, with my eye now, I suppose, on Naaman, in a foreign land, if the sacrifices were offered on an altar built of earth taken from God's land, or possibly if the worshipper knelt on earth taken from God's land. And the curse that David pronounced on such men was entirely justified, consistent with several sections in Deuteronomy 13. Let arise among you a prophet or dreamer of dreams, saying, let us go after other gods, which thou hast not known. That prophet, that dreamer of dreams, put to death. If thy brother, son of thy mother, thy son, thy daughter, wife of thy bosom, thy friend, entice thee, saying, let us go and serve other gods, thou shalt surely kill him, stone him with stones, that he die, because he has sought to thrust thee away, to drive you away. Same expression as David's. They have driven me out today from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord. So to say by word or action, go serve other gods, was an extremely serious matter. And Saul, David is saying, needs to understand the implications of his relentless pursuit of David. It was, in effect, inciting him to break the first and greatest commandment. Like, the time's gone, I'm going to have to stop.